This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The number of Americans in prison has risen sharply over the last 30 years, mostly due to a combination of punitive sentencing laws and the so-called war on drugs. We currently incarcerate more people than anywhere else in the world, about 2.2 million people, a 500% increase since 1984. That increase has disproportionately targeted black men. Over half of our nation's prisoners are black. And for black men in their 30s, one in every 10 is incarcerated. There are also far too many women and juvenile offenders in jail for far too long. That is an issue that Governor Daniel Malloy is trying to solve with his new Second Chance Society plan.
Punishment for nonviolent offenses should not last a lifetime. They should not destroy a person's hope for redemption or simply for a better future.
In many cases, that better future depends on people being able to get a job, find a place to live, even vote. And advocates say more work is needed to help people rebuild their lives after prison. Today, we talk about the state of incarceration and what needs to change. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. At Where We Live, is there a better way to treat people committing nonviolent crimes than by sending them to prison? We'd like to hear some of your voices. Joining us in studio are advocates from the Malta Justice Initiative, a few ex-offenders affected by current sentencing laws. We're also joined by Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project and author of Race to Incarcerate. Mark joins us by phone today. Mark, welcome to Where We Live.
Good. It's good to be here.
I'm wondering first if you can give us a little bit more of the background here, the scope of the problem we're talking about here in Connecticut and across the nation. Just how staggering are these numbers of people incarcerated in America today?
Well, it is quite remarkable. Over the last four decades, we've had a really historic and unprecedented rise in the prison population. We go from a point where there are about 300,000 people in prison and jail in 1970. Today, we have more than 2 million people behind bars, and the racial, ethnic disparities among those people are quite dramatic. According to research from the Justice Department, a black male born today has a 1 in 3 chance of doing time in prison in his lifetime, a Latino male 1 in 6, and a white male 1 in 17. So these are really to my mind, shocking developments in terms of how we use our prison system.
Of course, we're going to be spending most of our program talking about what we do about it, looking for solutions to this issue, but let's just make sure that we understand where this problem comes from. I mean, we talk about mandatory minimum sentencing laws, three strikes and you're out laws, the Rockefeller drug laws, the war on drugs under the Reagan administration. Are these the main culprits, or is it something else that's adding to this, Mark?
Well, in the early years of the rise of mass incarceration in the 1970s, there had been a rise in crime in the late 60s, early 70s. And so all things being equal, more crime will lead to more incarceration. But since 1980, the dramatic rise in the prison population then has been entirely a function of changes in policy, not changes in crime rate. So essentially, two factors. One, we're much more likely to send people to prison for the same kinds of crimes than we once were. And secondly, when we send people to prison, we keep them there for longer periods of time. One of the many examples, the use of life imprisonment. Today, across the country, there are about 160,000 people serving a sentence of life in prison, which represents one of every nine people in prison. Some of them are eligible for parole, some of them not eligible for parole, but just a dramatic rise through changes in sentencing policy in how we employ these sentences.
And the costs are staggering. The costs of keeping people behind bars for an entire life runs into the millions of dollars in many cases. And one of the things we're going to look at, Mark, and I'd like you to weigh in, though, first, is it seems as though there are less costly ways to get at some of the social problems that we have than putting people behind bars for 40 years.
Well, I think there are. You know, conservatively speaking, it costs about $25,000 or $30,000 a year to keep a person locked up. If that person's a serial rapist, not too many people are going to worry about the cost of that. If that person's a low-level drug seller who's selling drugs to support his own drug habit, and we're spending $25,000 a year, it's not clear that that's helping that individual. It's certainly not helping the community, and it's really robbing having resources from other kinds of interventions. Now, you know, we want to be careful. We need to look at which kinds of programs can be effective, but there's a wealth of research that suggests that, you know, a variety of programs designed to provide preschool education, to encourage high school graduation, various kinds of family intervention, on a dollar-for-dollar basis can be more effective than continuing to expand the use of incarceration and getting better public safety results.
We're talking with Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. He joins us by phone today to lead our program about the high cost of incarceration in America, a lot of costs associated with it, and we're going to be talking with some advocates in studio here in just one moment. Last thing here before I turn to our other guest, Mark, that I wanted to get some context from you on. It's not just the number of people behind bars. When you look into the numbers and you see 7 million or so people who are on parole or probation, that means that there are so many people affected by the justice system in one way or another. Those are people who aren't able to get jobs in the same way that others are. Those are people who aren't able to reintegrate into society or the economy the way the rest of us are, and that's a huge cost too.
Well, it certainly is. You know, there's always been societal stigma, you know, around people who have a felony record, and it's been more difficult to convince employers to give them jobs and things like that. But over the last several decades, along with this tough on crime movement, has been a whole range of policies and practices specifically adopted to make it even more difficult for people to access the things they need, the opportunity. So we now have restrictions on living in public housing for certain kinds of felony convictions. If you've got a drug felony, depending on the state in which you live, you may be subject to a lifetime ban on receiving welfare benefits or food stamps. The right to vote is lost in almost every state for at least some period of time as a result of a felony conviction. So, you know, it begins to look in many ways, as many people have called it, almost as if you're a second-class citizen by virtue of your felony conviction. Now, there are legitimate punishments, which may include prison if you're convicted of a felony, but when we take away the opportunity for redemption, for rejoining the community, for being productive, then it's not only, in many respects, an undemocratic approach, but I think it's very ineffective, too. You know, if we send a message to people coming home from prison, you're a second-class citizen, that's not a very good way of getting them reintegrated back in the community.
Stand by for a second, Mark Maurer, as I bring in our next guest, John Santas, former CEO of Santa Energy and the chairman of the Malta Justice Initiative. This group wrote The Justice Imperative, How Hyper-Incarceration Has Hijacked the American Dream. It focuses on Connecticut's incarceration system and also how it sits within the American system. John, welcome to our program. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John. Thanks for having us here with you today.
I'd like to get, throughout the course of our hour, a little into what Multi-Justice Initiative is trying to do to solve some of these problems. But first, I'd like you to address maybe some of the top-line issues that we've laid out with Mark that are most concerning to you. I mean, what are the things that are the most important things for us to address as we consider a second-chance society here in Connecticut?
Well, Mark, John, we have a system here that's just not working. It's not working for anybody, not you, not me, not the incarcerated people, not the regular society. We are not increasing public safety, and we're spending much more money than we should be spending on this. So what we seek is a better way to do this. We know there are better ways. There are other states, other countries, other places that are doing this in a more rational, compassionate, humane, an effective way, and that is what we'd like to see happen here in Connecticut. We think it's very important for us in many, many ways.
Who's doing it better? Give us some examples.
There are a number of states. I mean, let's take Texas, for example. Around 7 years ago, they had the opportunity to build two new prisons because they had more people coming into prison. And someone down there in their state legislature had the presence of mind of saying, wait a minute, isn't there a better way we can do this? So what they did, instead of building two new prisons, they brought about a number of programs for treatment of people. 9 out of 10 people going to prison are mentally ill and or addicted. So therefore, they brought about a bunch of programs that treated people for their mental illness and or their addiction so as to avoid incarceration and to not have to go into incarceration and all the concomitant difficulties that Mark has just told us about. Well, funniest thing happened. Not only did they not build those two prisons, They closed five of their prisons since then. And that's how it can be done. And that's just one example. Many other states are doing wonderful work.
And Texas is a very big, very complex state. It has a very different political system than we have in terms in terms of who represents it in the legislature. It seems as though Texas might be the last place you think of as being an innovator on the cutting edge of the way we do incarceration.
Exactly. I mean, here in Connecticut, we have 18 functional prisons. In Texas, they have 78. It's a huge system, not as big as California. California is the biggest system of them all. They incarcerate 183,000 people in California alone.
Mark, any other highlights from states around the country that you think are maybe doing a better job than we are here in Connecticut or the Northeast?
Well, I should say, the Connecticut has made some good changes in recent years. I think there's a commitment from the current administration to reduce unnecessary incarceration. So the challenge is how to move forward. But, you know, we have seen over the last decade or so, there are actually three states, New York, New Jersey, California, that have reduced their prison populations by 25%. So not just, you know, tinkering around the edges, but a substantial decline with no adverse effect on public safety. And they've done this through a mix of policies and practices, reducing sentences in many cases for drug offenders or employing merit time for program participation, making it less likely that people be revoked to prison from parole on a technical violation as opposed to a new offense. That is, you know, if you get test positive for drug use, can they still keep you in the community but do better monitoring rather than send you back to prison? California voters just passed something called Proposition 47, which reduces a number of low-level property offenses from felonies to misdemeanors. So it'll result in fewer prison terms and substantial cost savings. So there's very intriguing policies being explored in a number of states right now that, you know, holds a potential for something, considerable in terms of reductions in the prison system.
We're going to get to some of your phone calls in a moment at 860-275-7266 as we talk about incarceration in Connecticut and America. I want to bring in Reverend Marilyn Kendricks, who's an associate professor for faith formation for the Church of the Redeemer in New Haven. Reverend, welcome to our program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
I also want to welcome in Kennard Ray, who is regional policy director at Rock United. He's an ex-offender, and he joins us today to talk about some of these issues as well. Kennard, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, John.
I'd like to ask both of you to maybe comment on some of what we've heard so far and talk about what you see as a positive in Connecticut, looking at what Governor Malloy is calling a second chance society. We've heard that California, Texas, maybe other states are working very hard to solve some of these issues. Does it seem, Reverend, that Connecticut is headed in the right direction?
I think for sure that the second chance society that the governor initiated or announced a few weeks ago is a good first step. I think that one of the problems with our system here in Connecticut and throughout the United States is this: these barriers that are set up that prevent people from reintegrating into regular society once they have paid their debt allegedly to society. It feels as if we have, no matter what your sentence is, it's a lifetime sentence, and people are not making irrational choices when they choose to reoffend and go back in when we have barriers to housing, barriers to eating, you know, can't get welfare, can't even food stamps. You know, you get off a bus, come to New Haven, get off a bus at 6 o'clock in the morning from prison with your few possessions in a paper bag, and if you don't have a family and a support system in place, there is almost nothing you can do. You can't get a job, you can't have no place to live, and so the second chance society to reduce some of these barriers, providing additional support for people on probation and parole, providing opportunities for people with low-level drug offenses to have those kinds of crimes defined as misdemeanors rather than felonies such that they don't have this barrier to employment, is a wonderful first step in getting us where we need to be.
Kinnard, and in a moment, I'd like to hear your personal story with this system. But first, address this from a policy standpoint, some of what you've seen, not only out of the governor, but what we've seen over the course of the last couple of years in Connecticut, because it does seem as though we're trying to address this problem that John and Mark have laid out so clearly, in which we truly have more people behind bars in a small state like ours than we have really, frankly, any right to or any right to be able to support. What have you seen from a policy standpoint that works for you?
Well, just going back to what John and Mark were saying, I think the fiscal argument is the first argument that's made, that this is a costly specter in front of us and just around us. The prison system or the overall penal system has been something that has become this costly albatross. But then going into what Marilyn was just saying, it's more than just money. We have to get away from looking at the numbers as arbitrary binary codes. There's people behind it. So what has been working, I think Mike Lawler and the folks at OPM have done a great job in closing prisons. That is a step in the right direction. But in looking at the Second Chance Society initiative, we also have to be cautious enough to speak to what Marilyn just spoke to in looking at the people and looking at, the support systems. We can't eviscerate the social safety net as it is right now and as it's been presented in the current budget proposal and think that it's not attached in any way to creating a Second Chance Society, because it is.
So essentially what you're saying is it's one thing to say that we want to treat prisoners, ex-offenders differently, but it's another thing to not have the actual systems in place. And this budget right now, as it stands, is actually taking a pretty good whack at a lot of social service systems.
Correct. Because you hear it all the time. When someone is incarcerated, it's not just that person. It's a whole family. And when you're dealing with communities of families, we can pick any community we want in this state. This state is just a microcosm of the rest of the country, because there's community on top of community of people going through the exact same things, the exact same issues. If your mom, who probably is your support system in many families, because all the men are in prison, and if she's as a Latina, making 54 cents on every dollar that a white man makes, or a black woman making 64 cents on every dollar that a white man makes, and you're going back to that home, but wait, maybe you can't go back to that home because of your felonies. Maybe when you go back to that home, the support services have been cut, if we're looking at the current budget. So we have to start setting realistic goals if we really want to attack this problem.
I want to get to a quick phone call here before I take our first break. Patty is calling from Wallingford. Hello, Patty.
Hello. I'm calling. I kind of represent Seeking Justice for the Innocent, and I'm wondering if there's policy conversation around the practice of charge stacking, because sometimes what ends up happening is the charges get stacked up so high and the mandated sentences are so high that the person who might even be innocent is looking at a really long time in prison and ends up taking a plea bargain. So they have a conviction. They have all the problems that you're talking about here, but they were innocent from the beginning.
Mm. And Patty, thank you very much. John, do you have a thought on that? Because this is where a lot of this starts, is in the way in which we prosecute crime in America, the way plea deals are structured. The fact is that a lot of people go to jail because they have almost no other choice but to go to jail.
Well, John, thanks for John. I'm a member of the Connecticut State Sentencing Commission, so I'm sort of at the front line of some of the contemplations of these things. It's not an easy thing to deal with. Most people think that there are trials that take place when someone's arrested. Rarely,
almost in
rarely,
no cases. Yes,
rarely. It's a thing where the prosecutor makes a plea bargain with the accused, and off they go, and that's pretty much it. And sometimes they're well represented, and sometimes they're not so well represented. I mean, public defenders do a wonderful job here in the state of Connecticut, but generally speaking, they are overburdened with a tremendous caseload. So consequently, as this young woman's pointing out, we can get into charge stacking. And, you know, take a young person of the inner city who maybe is a high school dropout and doesn't have a good support system. They don't have an uncle, an aunt, a father, a mother, somebody to say to them, hey, look, wait, we can do this in a better way. They get swept up in the system and off they go. Mm. And that's the end of that.
Mark Maurer, we've got to let you go, but I'm just wondering if you can comment on that from a more from a national perspective, too. That is something that doesn't just happen in Connecticut. It happens everywhere across the country. What do we do about it?
Well, it's very challenging. You know, I think part of it is we need some leadership from the top. You know, we see at the national level, Attorney General Holder has been concerned about the excessive use of mandatory sentencing for lower-level drug offenses. And about a year and a half ago, he issued a memorandum to his prosecutors essentially saying if there are cases where the drug offense is relatively low level, there's no significant criminal history, that he wanted to get the prosecutors to avoid charging as a mandatory penalty. You'd still go ahead and prosecute, but not as a mandatory subject to 5 or 10 years in prison. And just last week, he announced that he believes this initiative is successful. Previously, two-thirds of drug offenders were subject to mandatory penalty. Now that's down to half of drug offenders. So I think that's how some of this change can come about.
Mark Maurer is executive director of the Sentencing Project and the author of Race to Incarcerate. Mark, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me as well.
When we come back, we're going to hear from a few ex-offenders to tell their stories. We're taking your tweets at Where We Live, including TXB, who tweets is not only about how long they're in prison, but what they can do when they get out of prison and how to stop reoffending. It's one of the questions that we'll tackle as we talk about incarceration in Connecticut and America today on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about how to fix America's broken incarceration system. It's a conversation we will be continuing on Thursday, March 5th at the Mark Twain House and Museum in Hartford. I'll be talking with journalist Nell Bernstein, who's the author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. 1 in 3 American school children will be arrested by the time they're 23. Many of these youth will spend time in detention centers that do not incorporate everything we know about how to rehabilitate young offenders. This conversation is a project of the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center, Community Partners in Action, Juvenile Justice Alliance, and the Mark Twain House and Museum. If you'd like more information, it's on our website, WNPR.org. Today, we're talking about incarceration with John Santa, who is the chairman of the Multi-Justice Initiative. This group wrote The Justice Imperative, How Hyper-Incarceration Has Hijacked the American Dream. We're also joined by Reverend Marilyn Kendricks, who's associate pastor for faith formation for the Church of the Redeemer in New Haven. Whenever I say associate, I almost always say professor afterwards, so my apologies to you, Reverend.
That's okay.
We're also joined by Kennard Ray, who's regional policy director at Rock United. He is himself an ex-offender or a formerly incarcerated person, as I've been told to say. we'll talk more about that in a moment. And also joining us by phone is Cindy. She's a recovering addict, someone who joined us to talk about her experiences as well. Cindy, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering, could you tell us briefly your story about how it was that you came to be in prison and how difficult it was afterward?
Well, like you said, I'm a recovered addict. I got into some trouble because of that. You know, I committed a crime to support my drug habit in 2007, and I ended up going to Niantic, York Correctional, for 3 years after that. And, you know, I've been home now since 2010, and right now I'm currently on special parole, what they call special parole in the state of Connecticut, which is kind of like a court-imposed sentence, but you're on the outside while you serve it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It's like not like discretionary parole, except that it has some different stipulations to it. So I find that, you know, it's nice to be out. It's nice to be home, obviously. There are some restrictions when it comes to being on special parole because, you know, you have that kind of that tag attached to you. So if you go for a job or if you go for any kind of, like, maybe assistance or something, and they look at that you're still under state supervision, it kind of inhibits a lot of the opportunities that you know, you would probably get if you didn't have that attached to your name.
Cindy, in just a moment, I want to ask you more about the transition to being back in society, trying to deal with some of the issues that people who have spent time in jail have to deal with. But first, can you talk about the front end of this? I mean, is there something specific about the circumstances behind which you went to prison, that you think some policies may change? Is there something that you look back and say, well, if this one thing hadn't happened, I wouldn't have had to spend 3 years behind bars?
Well, sure. If I could have gotten, you know, adequate drug treatment, that would have, I probably would not have gone to prison to get clean and sober. You know what I mean? But treatment back in 2007, maybe even today, is, you know, it's not perfect. There is a very low success rate, especially for people that are opiate addicts, which was what my drug of choice was. Heroin was my drug of choice. And it's a very difficult drug to recover from and, you know, lead a normal life. You don't get it the first time, maybe not the second time, and whatnot. So I didn't get, you know, enough treatment that helped me get clean and sober before I committed the crime. So that would have definitely helped. You know what I mean?
The crime that you committed, from what I understand about it, and you can tell me more about it, you were essentially charged as a violent offender, although you did not have violence in your background. Can you explain what the charge was and why you were sentenced the way you were, near as you can tell?
Sure. It was third-degree robbery, which in this state is a Class D felony. Okay. There's no weapons involved. There's no alleged weapons involved or threats of violence. But in the state of Connecticut, any kind of robbery, first, second, third degree, is considered violent. Now, my particular crime was bank robbery. Sorry to say, it's so hard to say that, but it was bank robbery, and it was with a note. And there was nothing. There was no there was no implied violence. I wasn't threatening anybody. I didn't say I had a weapon. I didn't have a weapon. But because of the statute that it falls under, the crime, it's violent. And I had never been arrested before in my life. I had before I got hooked on the heroin, I had worked. I'd owned a home. You know, it started out with surgery years ago with Percocets and Vicodins. And, you know, the next thing I know, as I'm hooked on opiates, and then, you know, heroin comes along, because that's how the progression seems to be. It's like, you start with, innocently enough, with some, you know, prescription opiates, and the next thing you know, you have this habit that is hundreds and hundreds of dollars a day, and you can't afford it, and then heroin comes along, which starts out as a very cheap drug, but then as your tolerance builds, it becomes a very expensive drug, and eventually, if not treated, it's going to lead to some kind of criminal activity.
And this pathway from prescription opiates that goes to heroin is something we've talked about on the program, and is obviously a huge problem in our state and in the region. Kennard Ray, I'd like to hear your story about how it is that you came to be behind bars.
Sure. So I'll go back to Mark Maurer's point of the prison boom from 1970 to now. Where in 1970, you find 300,000 people incarcerated across the U.S., period. I was born in 1981. So I think it was enough of a norm in this boom by the time I was, by the time I came to be forced to lock people up and to create norms within certain communities where, your first option was not college. It was whatever it may be. And so for me, it was drug dealing. I think that was the most available resource at the time. I don't want to say the easiest option, but the most visible option towards economic achievement. Obviously, it's backwards thinking, but who's to say that when it is the norm? How do you change that when it is the norm? I think for me, after, let's say, the 1996 Violent Crime Control Act, because we did mention the Reagan prison boom, but there also was the Clinton prison boom that sent our numbers much, much higher. And I think around that time, when we were in the time of the super predator, any small offense, whatever it was, truancy, hanging out past a certain time, because in Hartford at the time we did have a curfew for people under a certain age, it'll go back to what the caller was saying as charge stacking. You know, charges stacked on end, they give you a first entryway into juvenile detention. A juvenile detention system that our Office of Policy and Management has cited as being guilty of disproportionate minority contact. So I was lucky enough, I guess, to come in at a time where this disproportionate minority contact specter was kind of a new thing. And I went through the system, and I guess we term it as the prison, the school to prison pipeline. My first introduction was in the juvenile justice system, and then streamlined up from there.
You mentioned a lot of things that were going on in the country at the time. I mean, in the Hartford area specifically, there was starting in the early 1990s, there were gang wars. There was a lot of fear about drugs in society and the impact that they had. How much of a role do you think that played, Kennard? Just this fear that people had about not just young black or Latino men having to sell drugs to get by, but that they were connected to large, sometimes multinational drug dealing gangs that were terrorizing parts of American cities like Hartford.
Right. So today I wonder how much of that fear was manufactured. I wonder how much of the cart was put before the horse when you come up with loaded catchphrases like the super predator, which was not conceived by Clinton but definitely carried by him throughout his run in 96. And I mean, he's also the first president to ever sit in on an execution during his first run, his 1992 run, to show that tough on crime stance. So I personally wonder how much of that, you know, as we begin to militarize the police departments across the country with small tanks and submachine guns, how much of that was manufactured? How much of the gang activity was a response to fear? Because I know in my neighborhood, the people you feared more than the gangs were the police. That's my wonder. That's my question.
I'd like to bring in Reverend Kendricks before I ask Kennard and Cindy to talk about something. And it's this idea of why we put people behind bars in the first place. We've talked an awful lot about fear in the American public, politicians wanting to be tough on crime. And some of this is reality. And in hindsight, a lot of it just looks like terrible policy. But there is in American society this notion that if someone does something wrong, violent offense, even a nonviolent offense that may hurt some people, that we've got to punish them for it. I'm going to ask Cindy and Kennard to just talk a little bit about that aspect of it in a moment, but I'd like to hear your perspective on that, because we are so tied up in the idea that we need to punish people for crimes. There is something to that, but at what point does it need to end? How far do we need to go to make sure that someone has served their time for doing something wrong?
I think that's one of the things that most disturbed me about this when I first learned about mass incarceration and what was going on in America, because, we live in a nation of second chances where, you know, people have come here with this notion that we can start life over, we can be forgiven for whatever's gone on before. You know, from a person of faith perspective, forgiveness is at the very heart of who we are, and yet somehow we have used criminal offenses that people do, mistakes, often mistakes by very young people whose brains, prefrontal cortex, haven't completely developed, and they make these decisions to do things that are criminal. And we want to exact a punishment. And somehow I think the political system that Kennard mentioned has used that as a lever for gaining votes. You know, you can a surefire way to get elected is to be tough on crime. And to be tough on crime, we're going to punish these people. And it has gotten to such an over-the-top place where punishment is the be-all and end-all, where, you know, used to be, long time ago, we thought of prisons as places where people could find redemption. You know, penitentiary, where people could serve a penance and then come out and start again. And somehow we've gotten away from that in the last 40 years, where we're just about punishment, and now it's gotten so over the top that there is no end to the punishment.
It is something we've discussed on our program actually fairly recently, that one place where that has not extended is in how we view people who commit crimes in a corporate boardroom or perhaps on Wall Street. We seem to think differently about punishing people when they are the same people who hold power, when they look like the same people who hold power. Does that sound about right to you?
Oh, yes, for sure. I mean, the very reason that I became involved in this in the first place was through the window of poverty. And over 75% of the people who are incarcerated in our nation were living below the poverty line before their imprisonment. So it's not that we want to punish everyone who has committed a crime, even the same kinds of crimes. So we have people who commit crimes at the high end, the very rich, who really have a huge impact on us as a society, if we take a look at 2008 and the bank crisis. And we don't punish them. And yet the folks at the very low end committing very low-level crime that hurts essentially no one but them, we over punish. It's almost like, you know, we have the poor and they're not the deserving poor.
I want to ask Cindy this first. Obviously, Cindy, you take responsibility for the things that you did do to put yourself in prison. Could you talk about how this idea of punishment and reconciliation and corrections really sits with you, this idea that we need to exact some punishment from someone like you or someone like Kennard who has done something that is illegal but maybe paid far too much for it? How do you think about that today?
Well, you know, there has to be consequences. There have to be consequences for what you do. I'm totally, you know, in agreeance with that. But the thing is that, you know, people come to prison for different reasons and have different backstories. You know, there's like addictions, mental illness. There's all kinds of underlying issues that need to be addressed when a person does go into a correctional facility. I mean, that's why they call it corrections, I think, is that you're going to come in there and hopefully come out a better person. And that's not necessarily the way our correction system is set up in this country. You know, there's not enough treatment. There's, you know what I mean? Like, I know when I was there, it was very difficult to get into the most basic of programs like AA or NA. I had a very hard time. It took me almost 2 years to get to an AA meeting, and I knew I needed to go to this. You know, I was in total, like, acceptance of my addiction and where it had taken me and whatnot. But there's a lot of women that I knew that, you know, they had some pretty serious mental illness. I mean, these are not like mood disorders we're talking about. A lot of these women come in with borderline personality, you know, other personality disorders, PTSD and whatnot that needs some serious therapy, which is not available. Like, when you put somebody in prison, do you want somebody to come out that's a better person, or do you want the same person to come out, the person to come out the same way that they went in, broken?
Well, I want to ask Kennard about this. Okay, you are someone whose name people might recognize, in part because you paid a price professionally once you came out of prison, long after you came out of prison. Tell us about that, and tell us about how you feel like you have paid for the crime that you did, both in the time that you served and then also in the stigma and other things that were attached to it.
Sure. So to speak first to paying the price again professionally for folks who were in tune with, I guess, my hiring at the mayor's office in Hartford, I think it was 2014. you know, I did not apply for a job. I did not go searching or looking for a job. I was contacted by the mayor's office for a particular position. I accepted. I thought that it would be a great move, not just for me personally, but it would give the city an opportunity, folks from the formerly incarcerated community, to have something to look towards, to say, okay, you're not shut out of society once you've made the mistake, let's just say, or once you there is an end to paying the price. We quickly found out through the media that that's not true. There's a price to be paid continually. I don't know when you stop paying the price. It's a question that I still have. I'm actually still living through because, you know, it's so at one time, I think the last time I was on this show, my criminal background was not a question. Now I have to, you know, call it to question, and I have to answer that question all the time. That is something that when I go and apply for a job now, it's something that's right out in front of me. So I think that, you know, we have to figure out a way to make sure. And I think that the Second Chance Society initiative at least looks to address that. It looks to address the pardon system. It looks to address the path to employment. But there's also the social stigma outside of just employment. There's folks who I'm sure look at me in a different way today than they did 18 months ago.
Mm. We're talking with Kennard Ray. We're also talking with Cindy. They are people who both serve time behind bars, and we're talking about the incarceration system in America today. When we come back, we'll talk more with John Santa, whose group, the Malta Justice Initiative, wrote The Justice Imperative, How Hyper-Incarceration Has Hijacked the American Dream. We're also joined by Reverend Marilyn Kendricks, who is from the Church of the Redeemer in New Haven. We've got a lot of people who want to join us at 860-275-7266 on the phone right now. We'll get to some of those calls when we come back where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, for 1 year, journalist Karen Brown set out to learn why more young doctors aren't choosing primary care. Karen will join us along with some doctors to weigh in on some of the latest trends to tell us what the future of primary care looks like, both here in the Northeast and across America. Today, we're talking about mass incarceration in the United States and here in Connecticut. I've got another conversation coming up with the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center and the Mark Twain House and Museum on this Thursday. It's with Nell Bernstein, the author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. Hope you can join us for that. More information on our website, WNPR.org. A lot of people want to join our conversation today, so let's go first to Jeff, who's in Hartford. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's up?
I want to just touch base on a couple things. I am encouraged by Governor Malloy's new initiatives. However, I just want to touch on a couple things. Connecticut was one of the last states in the nation to change the juvenile age from 16 to, it's currently from 15 to 16, 17. However, some of the additional reforms weren't with that, meaning that currently, although those 16 and 17-year-olds are treated as juveniles in a system that keeps, you know, their record from the public and other protections for juveniles, many of those cases are still transferred to the adult system under mandatory transfer systems and also hold mandatory minimum charges. The second thing I wanted to discuss, your previous one of your callers mentioned in regard to going to trial, that sometimes innocent people may take a deal rather than go to trial, and it's what I call the trial penalty. Because our system in Connecticut is so backlogged with cases, and I work in, I'm a public defender here in New Haven, because the case system is so backlogged, what happens sometimes is if everybody went to trial, it would choke up the system. So if someone does go to trial and they're found guilty, rather than get what they may get with a plea negotiation or something close to that, they get sometimes three or four times what they would get with a negotiated plea. So those are a couple of things I wanted to maybe have discussed.
Jeff, thank you very much for that. John, I'm wondering if you have a quick follow-up on that, because I think he raises some good points.
Those are excellent points. And unfortunately, getting back to Marilyn's point that she made earlier, the people that most need the representation to deal with those charges have the least amount of it. And the people that least need it get the most of it. I mean, I would take just as an example, crack cocaine versus powdered cocaine. The penalties for powdered cocaine are one-tenth that of crack cocaine. And powdered cocaine is a very trendy drug of rich, yuppie kind of people, whereas crack cocaine is what the homies in the hood are using that stuff. So isn't that interesting? 10 times the amount of time you'll do for crack versus powder cocaine.
We're getting some tweets here, including one from Eduardo, who calls our conversation today our most unbalanced show in a long time. I assume he thinks that we have had other unbalanced shows. But Eduardo continues, what support systems do the victims of crime have? Mention these also. One of the things, John, that I think is important about any conversation like the one that we're having today is that crime has real consequences. And any crime that happens, usually someone pays down the line. The focus of our conversation today, I think, and the focus of the work that you're doing with Malta really has to do with nonviolent offenders, people who are doing drugs, selling drugs, and there are consequences to that. But at the end of the day, these are not people who are raping and murdering and stealing things from people at gunpoint. That is a different thing, and I don't think that that's what we're talking about today. I could be wrong.
No, you are absolutely right on, John, because the fact of the matter is prisons and the incarceration system performs an important function in society, always has, does now, always will. Some people are not fit to live in free society. They just can't do it. They're not capable of doing it. What we're dealing with is the fact that 6 out of 10 people in prison are there for nonviolent crime. They are there often for victimless crime. You're a drug user, you're a drug abuser. My goodness, you know, the only person getting hurt is you. And our issue, the issue we have, is not incarceration, but hyper-incarceration. Mm. And that's what it is. The man that raises this point about victims are very important, and we think so too. We think they should be absolutely taken care of and reconciled with and treated and helped in every way possibly they can. The fact of the matter is, if we spent less money on putting away low-level people in prison, we could spend more money on helping people who are victims.
Andrew is in New Haven. Quickly, if you would, Andrew, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I have two questions. What is John and the Malta Initiative trying to do to get the folks up in the General Assembly to take this issue seriously? Have they been in touch with the Senate Majority Leader and the Minority Leader? And secondly, how can people get involved with the Malta Justice Initiative? Because it sounds like a wonderful organization.
John?
Two things. First of all, we've met with the governor, and we've also met with the leadership in the Senate, both majority and minority. And I must say they have all been very responsive to what we're talking about, and we anticipate within the next couple of weeks we're going to have a legislative breakfast to introduce the justice imperative to all people, to all of our General Assembly members, so that they can see it as a resource for them. We're not presuming they accept everything we say in our book, but we think it's a wonderful resource for them. Secondly, as far as someone wants to get engaged, go to our website, the Justice Initiative, Malta Justice Initiative, and sign up and become a Malta Justice Associate. Just give us your email. We'll keep you informed of what's going on and give you the opportunity to engage.
Reverend Kendricks, you're going to be speaking at Niantic Community Church. It's a panel on mass incarceration. It's happening Sunday, March 8th at 3 p.m. in the First Congregational Church of Southington. That's on Wednesday, March 11th at 7 p.m. Can you tell us quickly about those?
Sure. One of the things that I've been doing for the last 2 years is trying to raise awareness about the issue of mass incarceration around the state of Connecticut and in other states, because when I came to this topic, I knew nothing about it, you know, and when I learned what was going on, I was incensed, and I thought, surely there's something we can do. This is not right. And I felt that other people of faith around our state and nation would be as concerned as I was if they knew. And so I've been spending time over the last 2 years preaching and teaching at churches throughout the state to bring awareness to what's going on.
And our Reverend Marilyn Kendricks is Associate Pastor for Faith Formation at the Church of the Redeemer in New Haven. We'll put more information about these conversations on our website, WNPR.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Kennard Ray, Regional Policy Director at Rock United. Kennard, thank you so much. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, John.
And thanks to John Santa from the Malta Justice Initiative. The book is The Justice Imperative. Thank you, John.
Thanks for having us on your station.
Thanks also to Cindy, who joined us by phone today. You can continue the conversation at WNPR.org. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.